Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Martha Minow recently announced that she will step down as the dean of Harvard Law School at the end of this academic year. She began her tenure there in 2008 in the midst of the financial crisis. And in the intervening years, the law school faced serious questions about diversity and racism. And as Martha Minow ends her tenure this year, parts of the legal profession are feeling a new ripple of energy around the presidency of Donald Trump. So let's begin our conversation, though, by listening back to a clip of a 2015 commencement speech that Martha Minow gave at the University of Michigan.
What does it take to stand up against what is wrong? And when and how should we? We have a word for not standing up. The word is bystander. It means a person who is near but does not take part in what is happening. We don't have an obvious word for its opposite, but here's a new one, upstander.
Upstanders. Yes. What did you mean by that?
Well, thanks for taking a look at that. I actually, for much of my career, have been very interested in the relationship between law and justice. It's always intrigued me that we call these law schools instead of justice schools. And one of my goals as dean was to put on the table, where's justice? And my own research has looked very much at issues such as genocide and what does it take to prevent mass human rights violations. There are willing people who actually don't like what's going on, but are standing by. And that's the bystander problem. And actually, terrible things cannot happen if people actually refuse that role and instead stand up against injustice.
Did you grow up in the kind of family where being a bystander wasn't an option?
Correct. Absolutely. And I'm really proud and lucky that my family has been engaged in politics and in public life for more than one generation.
Well, let's be specific, right? Your mother, Josephine, she was a civic activist. Your father, Newton Minow, he was what, chair of the FCC?
He was.
Under President Kennedy?
He was. And both of them have remained very involved in civic life.
What was dinner table conversation like in the Minow family when you were younger?
I would say I didn't really realize until I was in law school that it was unusual to be expected to have views on the issues of the day. But we were expected to participate as my parents would come with the topics they were working on and ask our views.
So your father he's widely credited as being one of the people who really founded modern public television, right? Were you asked to argue at the dinner table on behalf of why tax dollars should go to supporting public broadcasting or not?
Let's be clear. He's been a lifelong advocate of public radio as well. Although he's well known for calling television a vast wasteland, when he was involved both in the government and then in the private sector in improving television, he would sit the children down and ask our views of various shows on TV.
Wow. So do you remember the type of shows that he asked you about?
Oh, sure. I mean, these were early yeah. children's television yeah. shows that were about science, particularly.
And what was your verdict?
I think we didn't hold back.
A very lawyerly response, if I do say. Given that, that family environment that you grew up in, there actually could have been many avenues that you pursued. Was going into the legal profession always something that had called to you?
No, actually, I was going to do anything but law, and I really thought I'd be a journalist. And there was a moment in college, it was the Watergate era, and I was working in Washington. I had an internship with a congressman, and I thought the journalists were heroes, but I also thought I personally wanted to be more directly in the fray.
Uh-huh. So Watergate was the moment that
yes.
helped you through. Interesting. Okay. And so then the fray was going to law school.
Well, it's true. It's also true that education reform has been at the core of my own professional work, even again going back to high school where I worked on education reform.
Yeah.
And I went to graduate school in education.
Oh, the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Exactly.
Right.
And my goal was to work on, it was civil rights. It was the second year of Boston busing. And access to education for kids with disabilities. Those were my issues. And what I found was that lawyers were dominating all the discussions. Lawyers were in charge of framing what the policy debates were. And so I went to law school out of self-defense.
Huh. So, I mean, at that point in time, though, did you think it was a good or bad thing that lawyers were so dominating the discussion?
I had mixed views, but I felt pretty strongly it was a language that allowed people to be at the table, and I wanted that.
Okay, so you went to Yale Law School.
I did.
So when you wrapped up your time at Yale, did you know which direction you wanted to take your legal degree? Because as you said earlier, there's so many ways that one could go.
I had every expectation of going to be a civil rights lawyer. Yeah. I had the great opportunity to be a law clerk, including a law clerk to my lifelong hero, the person I admire so much, Justice Thurgood Marshall.
So tell me what it was like to clerk for Justice Marshall.
Clerking for Justice Marshall was an extraordinary opportunity because he, of course, is a world historic figure. He's also known for his storytelling. I mean, absolutely riveting raconteur who could play every role, who could play every part of the experiences that he had, some that were public and some that were much more quiet and private. But also, in addition, he was a really fantastic lawyer. And I learned a tremendous amount from him about how to analyze a case, about the relationship between procedure and substance, about who's a good oral advocate.
Now, what kind of relationship did Justice Marshall have with his clerks? Did he shower you with good advice, or what was it?
So Justice Marshall was a teaser. He had nicknames for everyone, and they weren't always complimentary. And
yours was?
Oh, Shorty. I had many. Shorty, girl, many topics like that. And if one of us bristled, he said, just get used to it. You're going to be called worse when you get out there. I'll never forget. I once wrote a memo on a particular case recommending a course of action. He threw it on my desk and he said, this is bleeding heart liberalism and it'll persuade nobody, including me. High standards.
Wow. What an experience that must have been. But since we're talking about Justice Marshall and about civil rights as a whole, let me just briefly ask you, for a while now, there has been sort of this meta-level criticism of Harvard Law School as not having diverse enough faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that as you look towards the end of your tenure
sure.
as dean.
So one of my aspirations as dean, since I had been such an advocate for increasing diversity of the faculty as a professor, was to do what I could on that score. Since I've been dean, in all of the job offers that we have made for faculty people, faculty posts, half of them have been to women. That's unprecedented. And we went from one African-American woman on the faculty to six since I've been dean. And that's just a tip of the iceberg. Many, many different kinds of diversity along methodological lines. We have many more historians and people who use psychology. And many more people who are connected with other parts of the university, as well as several who actually were not born in the United States and studied law in other countries. So there's a way to go, but it's a much more diverse place than it was when I joined the faculty, I can say, in 1981.
You know, I know it's a great conversation when every answer that someone gives me makes me think about 15 additional questions. So I'm struggling here a little, which way to take this conversation. But let me get back to you and your career, because I think
Thanks.
That's maybe the part that many people don't know enough about. You actually spent some time working on Kosovo after after the Kosovo War or during the war? I can't remember.
There was a wonderful justice then at the Constitutional Court of South Africa, Goldstone, who was appointed to head a commission on Kosovo.
Mm.
And he asked me to serve on it, which I did. And that certainly drew me into a very difficult legal question. Was the humanitarian intervention lawful? And if it was not lawful, was it justified?
Did engaging in that investigation, that work in trying to answer those two questions, did that challenge what your view of the
yes.
intervention in the 90s? It did.
Absolutely. Because I was against the war. And I did conclude with the commission that it was unlawful, but I was persuaded that it was justified by the evidence that we had presented to us.
Unlawful but justified.
Yes. So why? Because there were gross violations of human rights. It violated the steps that the international law at that time had in place. Since that time, in part because of our own commission report, international law seems to have changed.
Yeah.
And responding to imminent or mass atrocities that violate gross violations of human rights actually can justify the use of force if it's proportional. So that's pretty much where the commission came out, and I was persuaded despite where I came in.
Is this something that we're going to have to contend with again and again? Because it feels like in so many arenas, domestic international law, the law does lag behind.
It does. It does. The law, I think for good reason, lags behind because there often are new developments that are dead ends, that are false, that are not productive. But law catches up. And this is one reason I've for so long been so interested in the relationship between law and other fields, other disciplines, because we lawyers have an expertise, but it's an expertise in resolving disputes, setting up frameworks, making sure that there's order and continuity. But what's the content of the rules? How should they change in light of technologies that the framers of the Constitution, for example, never could have imagined? We need to hear from people with knowledge outside the law.
Aha, which is why Harvard Law School is doing a lot of cross-disciplinary stuff now, right?
Bingo!
you set me up for that. I mean, so you're talking about immigration, not just in terms of the letter of the law, but its impact. Needs of military veterans, things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just been an unbelievable privilege to help lead the school in building clinics in exactly these areas and to involve people from across the university and other places as well in our environmental work, for example, in our work on housing and after the foreclosure disaster. It is just a fact that any serious problem right now requires the contributions of more than one discipline.
I see this as a welcome change because the idea that that legal scholarship exists in a vacuum outside mm-hmm. of the society in which it has its impact has never made sense to me. To me, the letter of the law is sort of the codified conversation that we have with each other about what is acceptable and what isn't in the societies that we want to build. So to have that conversation outside of the actual society never. It's quite computed.
It's a beautiful summary of what law is and should be. One of the reasons I'm so happy that our faculty has such a strong group of historians is that people like Annette Gordon-Reed and Tomiko Brown-Nakin and Bruce Mann and Sam Moyne help us make sense and understand how law has evolved over time. And one of the ways in which law connects to society is by reflecting on how law itself has changed.
So then what are your thoughts on those who subscribe to originalism, like our newest Supreme Court nominee?
Interpret the Constitution in light of the original what? Intention? Well, that we don't know what was in the minds of the framers, and the framers couldn't imagine television, much less virtual reality. Is it to come up with some kinds of rules so that we look only at the past? Well, that's not going to be responsive to changing circumstances. I do understand the worry is that judges who are appointed and aren't accountable to an electorate may be pursuing their own point of view and not responsive to anything else. But Justice Scalia was fond of saying, I know originalism is faulty, but show me a better alternative. I think there are better alternatives. I think understanding how law evolves case by case by case, the way we described, that is one of the ways that judges are restrained from making leaps.
Yeah, interesting. Well, since we are talking about the court again, the Supreme Court, let me ask you, if Judge Gorsuch is confirmed, we will continue to have a 9-member court where all of the members either went to Harvard or Yale law schools.
It's true, although as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is right to remind
us. Oh, her Columbia connection.
Yes,
right.
She was a student at Harvard Law School for 2 years, and she petitioned to spend her last year at Columbia while still retaining a Harvard degree so that she could be with her husband and her child. And the then dean said no. So her actual degree is from Columbia.
Okay, point taken. I stand corrected. But you see what I'm driving at, because
I do.
This has been a this is a significant issue that's worthy of conversation, and people have been talking about it, about whether or not a court that's peopled entirely by folks who come from a very small set of law schools can adequately represent or even take into account the diversity of interests, opinions, backgrounds from people across the country, different socioeconomic levels, things like that. And also on top of that, I would add, we got a lot of prosecutors or former prosecutors on the court.
And we don't have very many people who actually ran institutions. Lena Kagan's the only one who actually ran an institution in the private sector. That's correct. Yeah. My former student. Well, you look, I think that there are many factors that go into the selection and approval of Supreme Court justices or any judge. I think that there is, however, the proper pressure to find the very best. When President Nixon nominated unsuccessfully several candidates, one defended himself on the grounds that the mediocre deserve representation on the court. I don't think that's a compelling argument.
I'm going to push back on that, though. The idea that the best only come from Harvard, Yale, or Columbia.
I did not say that.
I think I hear people at Stanford Law School or UT Austin are like just a.
I did not say that. And I have many of my former students are teaching at law schools all over the country, and I'm very proud of them and proud of the work that they do. I will say this, that it is a somewhat uninformed view to suggest that elite legal institutions like Harvard and Yale law schools are themselves insular and lacking diversity. Our students currently, 44% students of color, a large number first generation. We do our best to find talent in all corners of the world. And one of the great things about schools like ours and others, which would include Northwestern, Arizona, is that students come from different backgrounds and they learn how to talk with each other and learn how to grapple with the tough issues of the day. So I think that the kind of training that we offer prepares people for the job at stake.
Am I getting you fired up now?
No, I just want to say that having co-authored two amicus briefs in the Supreme Court defending the diversity and for affirmative action in our admission of to students, something I feel very strongly about, it's the character of our institution. So anyone who suggests that somehow these are not diverse places hasn't looked at them closely.
What about in terms of the justices having come from largely a prosecutorial background? Because it was some time ago I spoke with someone who said in his dream scenario, the next Supreme Court justice would be a public defender.
Well, I think there are all kinds of points of view that would be very helpful. I certainly think more experience with the criminal justice system, period, would be helpful. The fact of the matter is Justice Thurgood Marshall was the only one on the court, in my memory, who actually handled a death penalty case. And I think that that's an important, at least as a
handled one as in terms of being the lawyer representing the accused.
Being the lawyer defending the accused. I do think that if there's a concern, again, about the lack of diversity on the court, I would have some concern about how many have served in the executive branch of the government and therefore have that point of view, whether they are, I'm sure they all assiduously try to step outside of their past experiences, but it's hard to shake fully that point of view. Mm. In terms of geography, you know, I think Merrick Garland would have added to geographic diversity, and I'm sorry not to see him on the court.
One could say that Neil Gorsuch will, if he's confirmed, being from Colorado.
Yes, and liking to hike and fish.
And owning a ranch. So Dean Minow, let me ask you, I mean, we haven't touched on sort of some of the major controversies that engulfed Harvard Law School during your tenure, but we've discussed them more broadly. I mean, the law school moved to remove the family crest of the royal family from the symbol, the shield of Harvard Law School, in acknowledgement of the royals' slaveholding past. What was that like, having that conversation, that process going?
Sure. I'm really very proud of our community. We had a process that involved more than 1,000 people participating in the discussion to ultimately recommend to the university, because it was the university that had adopted the shield in 1936, that the shield be suspended. It was adopted without much attention to the history and what it meant as a symbol of the institution. And one reason I'm proud is that the report issued by the committee led by my colleague Bruce Mann is so learned and so thoughtful, and also produced an equally learned and thoughtful dissenting opinion. And when I read the report and forwarded it to the university, I thought, you know, I almost don't care what the university does now, although I endorse the majority recommendation, because this exemplifies what we stand for more than anything. Why was there a dissenting view authored by Annette Gordon-Reed and joined by a student? Because the view was, we don't want to eliminate our history. We need to pay attention to our history. We need to make sure that every subsequent generation learns our history. And we are making as strong a commitment as we can to make this very process and the report and its dissent part of the introduction to Harvard Law School.
You're going to stay on as a faculty member.
Yes.
And your advice for whomever may take your place.
Oh, three pieces of advice initially that I can say publicly, and then there'd be much more to say privately. But the three pieces publicly are, first, it's amazing how much you can get done if you don't need to take the credit. The second is, have a sense of humor and proportion. And the third is, make sure that you are the person with the smallest ego in the room.
Wow, that seems like a tall order for Harvard Law School. But Martha Minow is the dean of Harvard Law School. She'll be stepping down at the end of this academic year, but remaining on the HLS faculty. Dean Minow, it has been a real delight and pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
I'm such a fan. It's really a pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.